with more than a dozen shops, businesses, and restaurants, including Art Mart and Art Mart Toys, on the web at artmart-food-toys.com. And Boyer Drawing and Painting, producer of murals, scenic art, and faux finishing classes.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the show today, we will talk with a man who is a bona fide movie star, one of, in fact, the biggest screen idols of the 1950s. Our guest this morning in this first hour of the show is Tab Hunter. He was one of the last actors to be put under exclusive contract by a major studio. He was also, at one time, the most popular star that Warner Brothers Studios had. In fact, he was once named the most popular male movie star in the world. He has recently published an autobiography where he talks about both his personal and his professional lives. Tab Hunter Confidential is the title of the book. The subtitle is The Making of a Movie Star. It's published by Algonquin Books, is out in the bookstores now if you would like to read it. And this morning he's joining us by telephone from his home. He's been in a number of movies. In fact, he's been more than 50 movies. Damn Yankees, Battle Cry, That Kind of Woman, Ride the Wild Surf, Life and Times of Judge Roy Bean, Polyester, and Lust in the Dust, just to name a few. He's also appeared on stage and on television. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome from people who are listening. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana, or in fact, if you would happen to be listening on the internet, you can use the toll-free line as well. That is 800-222-9455. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and again, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Hunter, hello.
Oh, good morning.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Well, it's interesting that you're in that area because I used to work in the theater a number of times in the summer down in Sullivan, Illinois.
Oh, sure. Maybe some people who saw you when you were treading the boards down there in Sullivan. Well, I'm glad you could give us a little bit of your time.
Thank you very much.
You know, in the introduction to the book, one of the things that you say is that you felt like for such a long time, you really did not want to talk about your private life. And that you were just really reluctant to it, made you really uncomfortable. So I guess a natural question would be, why now have you decided that this is a story that you wanted to tell?
Well, I heard that someone was going to be doing a book on me. And my partner, Alan, said, I think you should write a book. And I said, well, who'd want to read a book on me? And he said, a lot of people. So I thought, oh, gosh, okay, I'll do this. But, you know, because I'm a great horse lover, and I said, let's get it from the horse's mouth, not from some horse's ass after I'm dead and gone. Because I know how people tend to carry on and go on and do all kinds of things, and people have no recourse whatsoever. I mean, you're long gone. But, you know, my whole life has been a very private life because I was raised that way. You know, nothing is for show. My mother always said, so what do you do? I wind up in show business. I mean, it's just really weird. But I loved the business, but I was also living two lives, and it was very frightening.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that it seems like has not changed is that the public seems to have an almost insatiable, or at least some part of the public, almost insatiable desire to know about people in the entertainment business, to know about the stars, to know about their lives, what they do at home, who they're sleeping with, you know, the whole deal. And there is an enormous industry that has grown up to provide that kind of information to people. So for people who are in the business, I'm sure that it's hard to have a private life. They're hooked into a system that they in some sense depend on because it promotes them and their work, so they have to be connected to it in part. And at the same time, you would like to have, I'm sure, a private life. How do you juggle, or how does one ever juggle that, you know, negotiate that sort of Faustian bargain between being hooked into an industry where that's just part of the deal, and at the same time feeling entitled to some kind of a private life?
I think people are entitled to their privacy, but I was in the business where major studios were totally different from what they are today. Today, they're large corporations. In those days, they took people, you know, we had one person that ran the studio, and they built careers. It was the last of the studio contract era. So they took this young kid with a new name, you know, hi, I'm Tab Hunter, and they forced me down people's throats. I mean, my gosh, I was in magazine covers, and they kept building a career. So I was doing this as a wide-eyed kid who wouldn't want to be a part of that? But by the same token, I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I have the other feelings, and I'm uncomfortable in these situations. And the only touch of reality I had my whole life were my horses. Mm-hmm. I mean, I felt, you know, that was my touch of reality in a really, really unrealistic world. But my job was to do as my bosses said, so I would do whatever they said. That was part of the job.
People, unless they're old enough to remember or have done some reading about Hollywood history, maybe wouldn't understand what it meant at that time to be under contract to the studio. It's not like that anymore. Now actors can work for anybody who will employ them, but that wasn't the case then.
Well, you're absolutely right there, David. Studios, they were very powerful. Now, you know, I was at the time when they were having to diverse, you know, just dump. They had theaters all around the country. They had to dump those. Television was coming in strong. A number of things were happening. There were major changes. Your audiences were leaving, you know, weren't going to the movies as they had previously been doing. And the young people were very popular. They were the ones who were they were the movie goers at the time. They wanted more of the young people in the business. So it was a whole different business. And I was thrown into the midst of all that. But regardless, PR is what builds people, and the press and the public built me up tremendously, but I found that they were just as quick to want to tear one down, the press particularly, and it was very difficult living, trying to live just, you know, a normal, decent life.
Yeah. It seems that one of the other differences, though, is that at that time, the studio had a big press operation, and they were tied into a lot of the media. And was it not the case that studios actually had perhaps a little bit more influence over what ended up being printed? Or maybe it's just that their voice was loud and there were some other voices, but the voice of the studio was much louder than the other ones.
No, I do think you're absolutely right there. For example, I had a dog trial. I went to trial. I wrote about it in the book, you know, for beating my dog. I love animals, but I mean, this thing was blown totally out of proportion, but I was no longer at Warner Brothers Studios. The studio would have nailed that. I mean, that would never have gotten blown out of proportion the way it had been. Yet, when Confidential magazine and things like that were coming on out, I made three covers and four stories. The studio was out there. I mean, they were powerful. There was no question about that. And they were there to protect and to build the young stars that they had. I was there with Natalie Wood at the time at Warner Brothers, and we had a wonderful time working together there. She was a kid, you know. It was a very, very exciting period.
Hmm. You tell the story of how you were discovered, and I don't even know if anybody in Hollywood talks like that anymore. Do people still talk about discovering?
Well, I think that's true. I mean, people are discovered for films here and there, absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people are, you know, trained and fall, you know, and just luck plays such an important part in it, and that's part of the luck. I was a stable boy at the stable at Dubrock's Riding Academy, and my good friend, even to this day, he's now 90 years old, but Dick Clayton was an actor in those days, and he got to know all of us kids at the barn, and he said, you should think about becoming an actor. And later he became an agent, but he introduced me to my first agent before he was an agent. Then he later became agent for Jimmy Dean, Jane Fonda, Burt Reynolds. I mean, you could just, you know, Tuesday Weld. You could just go on and on. I mean, he was really one of the true loyal people in the business, and trustworthy. But he, you know, that's where I started. I started truthfully as a stable kid.
So is it true, as the story goes, that you literally were shoveling horse manure?
Joke about that, David. I always say I was shoveling the real stuff as opposed to the other stuff.
he apparently saw you and just thought, here's a really good looking kid, and that was the fact that you were a handsome young man, and that he thought, well, you had movie star looks, and that was a place to start.
Well, I saw Dick Clayton all the time at the stable. He taught him. He'd be out there riding all the time and doing fan magazine layouts. I didn't know anything about fan magazines or any of that stuff. He would come out with Anne Blythe, and he would come out with this actress, and he would come out with that actress, and they would do photographic layouts at the stable. And that's where we all got to know him. And then he befriended me. I mean, he was like my brother. He was like a father. I could tell him anything in my life, and he was really good advice for me throughout my whole career, throughout my whole life, and to this day.
When you made your first movie, what sort of had you had much of any acting experience?
Oh, gosh, no. I did one role in a junior high school play. I was scared to death. And I was just thrown into it, you know, with a new name and the whole thing, and I was a nervous wreck. The very first film, I said, hi, Fred, and wound up on the cutting room floor, so I don't even count that. But the first starring role was a few years later, opposite Linda Darnell in a film called Island of Desire. And I had to do a screen test for that. But the moment I walked in to meet the writer and producer, the writer, Stephanie Nordley, took one look at me and said, that's the boy I want. And I thought, uh-oh, now what do I do?
And was that before or after they had you take your shirt off?
Well, then I had to take my shirt off. I don't remember if it was before or after, but it was at that point when I walked into the office, she said that. And then she introduced me to the producer, and they said, we want to do a screen test with you. So Linda Darnell, I did a screen test with Linda Darnell. I mean, here I was holding the Virgin Mary from the Song of Bernadette in my arms. You know, I was scared to death. And she was so magnificent. She leaned over and she said, don't worry, I'm good luck for newcomers. And she was so assured. People need that, and particularly when you're a stupid young kid, you know, not knowing anything about your craft.
Yeah. So when you were a kid going to the movies yourself, a long time before you ever made your first movie, when you were sitting there in the seats and you were looking up at the big screen, did ever in your wildest dreams occurred to you that one day you could be up there?
Well, I thought, gosh, I'd love to do that. I'd love it because I was such a great movie lover. I love the escapism. I mean, it's just so wonderful. I was so insecure as a kid. I was so shy. I was so stupidly, you know, shy. Just everything embarrassed me. Everything embarrassed me. I'd run to the movies all the time. Even when I was in the Coast Guard at 15 and a half years old, you know, guys would say, hey, let's go out to a bar. You know, they didn't know I was 15 and a half. And I said, I didn't like that stuff. I said, no. I'd go to the movies, or I'd go out to see my horses. And but they knew that I loved the movies, so they nicknamed me Hollywood.
We have a caller here. We'd welcome others if you'd like to talk with our guest for this part of Focus 580, Tab Hunter. He's published an autobiography about his life in the movies. It's titled Tab Hunter Confidential. It's just come out. Here in Champaign-Urbana, you want to call 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have someone listening in Indiana this morning, and here we go, line number four. Hello.
Hello. Very nice show, Dave. This is interesting. Because in a sense, I could say I grew up with Tab Hunter, a similar age in some respects. I wonder if you could make a comment about your singing career. I think it was Red Sails in the Sunset, but I may be way off bounds on that. And secondly, you mentioned you were in the Coast Guard, and it's sort of remarkable from the number of people who ended up in the movies who sort of did out-of-the-way kind of things when they were quite young. Like there are a number of people, you know, been in the Merchant Marine and things like that before they got their start. And secondly, if I'm not mistaken, I'm pulling this one out. Did you make some Italian films? And if you did, I wonder if you could make some general comment about their style and what that experience was like. And I hope others in your age group do autobiographies because, like you say, after you're gone, a lot of things can be said about you, and be nice. I certainly want to read this one. Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you. Those are really interesting questions. The recording came about. Actually, the flip side of Red Sails in the Sunset was Young Love, which catapulted right up to the number one song in the nation and stayed there for quite some time, and we knocked Elvis Presley right off the charts. And Elvis was really upset because we used his backup group called the Jordanaires. He was not too pleased about that. But then that came about when Natalie Wood and I were in Chicago with Howard Miller, who was a big radio disc jockey at the time, introduced me to Randy Wood of Dot Records, and that's where I recorded. So that's that. Now, as far as when things weren't doing really well for me in Hollywood, my agents got me a job in Italy, and I ran over there at that time to do a lot of spaghetti westerns, which I claim were sort of light on the meat sauce, if you know what I mean. They weren't very good, but I went to Europe to work because it's all about continuing working, keep working, keep working, keep learning your craft. I was very fortunate. I met some incredible directors and people over there, you know, people like Luchino Visconti and just wonderful people that really were influential in my life. I enjoyed doing that work over there, and I just kept trying to you know, succeed, you know, but then you really have to stop and realize, well, what is success? It's only really your own personal happiness. If you are happy, you are successful. It isn't the money in the bank or this or that. But I just kept trying to develop. I mean, that's what it's all about. We grow. As my mother used to say, I had a very strong mother, you grow until the day you die. And that is mentally, physically, and above all, spiritually.
The caller mentioned about your experience on the Coast Guard. You actually, when you entered the Coast Guard, you actually lied about your age so that you could go in.
I did, because the escapism of movies drove me nuts. I thought, look at the places in the world. I'm just, as a kid here, going to school, doing this. I want to get out and see the world, and to me, the Coast Guard seemed the place to go. The interesting thing, however, about the Coast Guard, David, is that my first thing was I was thrown out to sea on board the Coast Guard cutter Minnetonka, and we patrolled a 50-mile area in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. That wasn't terribly exciting, but it did make me realize how insignificant we all are in life. Then I was able to go to Connecticut to the Coast Guard training station, and that's when Dick Clayton was doing a play on Broadway, and he introduced me to Broadway and my first Broadway plays, where I saw live actors on stage performing, and I thought, oh, wow. And that's when he kept reminding me, if you're going to be an actor, you must work. You must work. But as a kid, I only took it with a grain of salt. I wasn't really, really dedicated until a few years later.
Hmm. You talk about the fact that you... particularly when your career was just taking off, you had this feeling that you were living this kind of double life. Because on the one hand, you were being promoted as this golden boy, greatly attractive to women, made movies with a lot of fabulous movie stars, female movie stars. And one time you were, Natalie Wood, I think, was also working for Warner's and was a big star there. And you and she were kind of paired up, and you traveled around together, and you were in the tabloids. And so there was this one public image that you had, your movie star image. And then there was a different life that you were living in your private life because you're gay.
Well, that's true. I was under... contract, and Warner's put me under contract only after I did Battle Cry, which was an enormous hit for Warner Brothers. And Bill Wellman saw rushes of the film and immediately cast me opposite Bob Mitchum, Teresa Wright, Diana Lynn, Beulah Bondi in a film called Track of the Cat. Then Warner's thought, well, what the heck, we've got him in two films, let's exercise his option and put him under contract. By that time, things exploded in my career, and Warner says, whoa, we better put this kid under contract. They had also done Rebel Without a Cause with Nat and Jimmy, and they thought, oh, my gosh, look how popular she is, look how popular he is. Let's throw them together, and we've got to find a project for them because we just won the audience awards and all this kind of nonsense. So they found the Louis L'Amour novel, The Burning Hills, and that's the first thing, and they started to build the two of us. Well, Nat, I'd known since she was 13 years old when we met at a March of Dimes parade. She was a kid. But at the time I was working with her, she was 17 and had her 18th birthday on the set. And she was wonderful because she was like a little filly finding her legs. You know, one moment she was a young girl, the next moment she was a young woman. And I found that really terrific about her. She was great fun to be with, and the studio decided to build us into a sort of poor man's Myrna Loy and William Powell or whatever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's all part of the PR grind.
Yeah. Well, at the time, how many other people in the business, people that you work with, knew that you were gay?
Well, I never discussed it. I mean, it was just, I was very, very fearful. My whole life was very private. I was a shy, I didn't like the spotlight. I only did those things because it was part of my job, but I was not comfortable. That was not in my comfort zone. I just to be photographed and be out there like that. But I was in awe of these people that I was meeting and seeing and getting to know. I mean, it was fascinating for a young kid at that time. I mean, here you are thrown into all of this. It's very difficult. And I really respected those wonderful actors coming from New York who had served their apprenticeship, you know, later, you know, getting to know Julie Harris, working with Geraldine Page, you know, Kim Stanley. I mean, gosh, you know, they were people that I looked up to, old Ben Gazzara, all those wonderful actors.
I don't want to belabor this point, and I know it's not as you say in the book, it's not something that you really, although you talk about it, you do talk about it in the book. It's something
that you about it because it's my life. It's my life. It's a part of my life. You know, I while I was doing Lafayette Escadrille, I was seeing Tony Perkins, I mean, for a couple, two, three years. But, you know, he had his career, I had my career.
So when particularly, I guess, when this scandal rag, this Confidential, which I guess liked to print scandalous stories about movie stars, not just about you, but about a lot of other movie stars as well, put out this allegation that you were gay, that the studio now, they had it was, as we talked about earlier, it was big enough to put out a counter message and a much louder counter message. But the other message was out there as well. Did that cause you any problems?
The funniest thing is when Confidential magazine came out, I was voted the most popular actor at the studio and around at the time, and it's amazing. People believe what they want to believe. People, and often, you know, and my mother was such a strong, very, very complex, but very interesting woman, and she set boundaries for my brother and myself when we were growing up. You must do this, you can't do that, you should do this. And it was very tough trying to live up to all the things that we were supposed to do and not do. I found that fascinating, having that conflict within myself all throughout all those years. But she was, you know, the sun comes up, the sun goes down, leaves come on the trees, leaves fall off. There must be an order to your life. And I was fighting for an order. And my reality throughout all that whole time were my horses.
Yeah, that's something that sounds like it's been a consistent thing throughout your life, that when you were, particularly when you were a kid, maybe the thing that you loved best almost of anything was to be around horses and to ride horses. And I guess that's still pretty much true.
And it's very true. And my brother was the one who introduced me. My brother, who was killed in Vietnam, you know, God bless him. He was just the most incredible person, the most incredible brother to have and friend. I mean, I was scared of my own shadow. And I could look up to him, and he would say, come on, let's do this, let's do that. And he helped me break out of my shell, which was really important. Mm.
You write in the book, I think also just in that introductory section of the book, apparently over the years a lot of people had said that rumors that you were gay killed your career. And you say you think that that's not true at all.
I don't believe that's true at all. I think a couple of, you know, people would never confront me with things like that. They knew I could just, I just didn't want to address those things. I don't think it killed my career. I think it just, my career in Hollywood ran its course. I did a number of films. I worked with some incredible people. You know, Gary Cooper, Fred Astaire, Van Heflin, three films with Van, Lana Turner, Natalie Wood, Rita Hayworth, Sophia Loren, Geraldine Page. I thank God for those fabulous years. And I don't think people that in my life, people might have said things behind my back. They never said anything to my face.
Well, sir, one of the things that we know even today is that as far as I can think of, the number of people who in the entertainment business who were openly gay is really small. So I guess that would suggest to me that it's just as difficult now as it would have been in the 1950s, do you think it is possible? Is it possible to have a career and to be open?
David, I don't really know about that, but in response to that, I just think of, let me go back to the 50s, the first thought that comes to my mind. There was a wonderful actor in France by the name of Jean Marais, who was the boyfriend of a man by the name of Jean Cocteau. He did a film called Beauty and the Beast. He was the matinee idol of France. So explain it. I don't know. I don't know. This, of course, things in Europe are a little more different than they are here.
I guess the other thing that's really tough and may also be continue to be true about Hollywood is that once the business gets the idea that you're a certain kind of person, you fit in a certain kind of role, they won't it's hard to do anything else, and perhaps that's why, or maybe I should just ask, do you feel that you wanted to be an actor, you wanted to do more, and yet the people in the industry looked at you and said, well, this is Tab Hunter. He is a certain kind of guy. We put him in a certain kind of part. The idea of you being a quote-unquote serious actor, they might say, well, no, that's not what this guy is.
Well, I think you have to work and prove otherwise. When I was nominated for an Emmy with opposite Geraldine Page on A Portrait of a Murderer, I did two Portrait of Murderers. When I worked with Sophia Loren in the Sidney Lumet film, that kind of woman, I don't think, people will put you where you want, and other people just follow along, other people behind other people. My mother said it. My mother said, the masses are asses. And it's just terrible. And I have to look at it and say, Mom, my mother would say to us, you are individual. That person is an individual. That person is an individual. You must think about that. And Geraldine Page said something to me that I really want to pass on to all your listeners, because this is really important. I said, Jerry, you're so fortunate. People love everything you do, and people just take pot shots at me constantly, and it really hurts. She grabbed hold of my arm, and she said, listen to me, Tab. Just remember this. If people don't like you, that's their bad taste. Well, I thought about that, and I said, Jerry, I will never forget that, and furthermore, I will pass that on to everyone I can think of, because it's important for all of us to think about that.
I think that's remarkable that someone who would be in a business where you were so dependent on people liking you could actually get yourself into a frame of mind where you would say, I don't care whether you like me or not.
Well, I've gotten to that point because I really don't care. I mean, I live my life, and I don't have to account to anyone except my maker. That's what it's all about.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Tab Hunter, made more than 50 movies. He's also appeared on television, acted on television, and also on the stage. Some of his movies include Damn Yankees, Battle Cry, Ride the Wild Surf, Life and Times of Judge Roy Bean. And then later on his career, also almost had a second career with the movies Polyester and Lust in the Dust. He continues to work as a film producer, makes his home in Southern California, has just published an autobiography, Tab Hunter Confidential, The Making of a Movie Star, published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. You made a lot of different kind of movies in your career.
It's called working, David. It's called working.
Well, I'm sure that's right. You know what? That's the way it is when you're an actor. You say, look, I need the work. I'll do it. It may not seem like a great idea at the time, but I'll do it. The thing that I'm really interested in having you talk about is how it is that you met and got to work with John Waters.
Oh, gosh, that was wonderful. I was doing a play in Indiana. I was on the dinner theater circuit that time. I was one of the pioneers of dinner theater. And John called me up. Crazy John called me up. He's like your friendly undertaker. He called me and he said, my name is John Waters. You may not have heard of me, but I do these kind of quirky films. And I said, never heard of you. I said, are you kidding? I loved Mundo Trasho. And he laughed. And he said, well, you know, I'm doing this little tiny film, and I was wondering if you might be interested. And I said, well, when are you going to do it? And he told me, and I said, well, that would fit in my schedule because I don't have to do a play for another 2 weeks. He said, well, there's only one problem. You'd have to kiss a 300-pound transvestite. How do you feel about that? And I said, well, I'm sure I've kissed a lot worse. Anyway, he sent me the script. I thought it was delightful, and I thought, what have I got to lose? I have everything to gain. Sidney Lumet said something to me many years ago. He's a very fine director. He said, I was doing a scene with Sophia, and he said, Tab, you're playing it safe in the scene. If you're going to play it safe, stay in bed all day long, safest place to be, and also the dullest. And I thought, Sidney, I won't forget that.
So now you made two movies with Divine.
Yeah.
It must have been quite the character, I'm sure. What was Divine like?
Oh, he was the best. He was like a big beached whale. Divine, I'd met at a David Hockney cocktail party many years ago. I did the film for John, and then I was putting together a script, an idea called The Reverend and Rosie, which then became Lust in the Dust, and I thought of Divine playing the role. It'd be wonderful. And working with him was terrific. I always joke kiddingly and say that he's one of my favorite leading ladies.
I saw the movie, and I thought that it was very entertaining, and it's... it's funny because it just seems like it's one of those movies that people make just, well, first of all, because they really want to make a movie and because they want to have a good time. And the idea of it being art, well, I don't know, maybe that's a little bit further down the line. It certainly did seem like you must have had a good time doing it.
Well, no, I had a good time on both films, John's film, Polyester, and our film, Lust in the Dust. I mean, I love doing them. It was very exciting. It was very exciting producing our own film, our first one, Lust in the Dust. In fact, I wanted John to direct it, but John said, unfortunately, that he only does his own things. And I can understand that. We got Paul Bartel to do it, but he didn't quite get understand the concept that I wanted for the film, that Alan and I wanted for the film. We wanted Divine in a Sam Peckinpah-type Western. I thought that would have been hysterical. And, of course, you know, bringing in Cesar Romero and Lainey Kazan was a stroke of genius on my partner's part for casting. I had worked with the Cesar in a film, and I knew that I would like to work with him again because he was a lovely human being. And Lainey is a very wonderful actress who should be working a great deal more.
Let's talk with another caller here, with somebody in Edgar County, neighboring county, line number four, right here. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Hey, David. I'm one of the people who saw Tab at Little Theater in Sullivan.
Okay. Oh, my gosh. was that Mr. Roberts?
Yes, as a matter of fact, because I did it about the same time at Illinois Wesleyan.
Hmm. That was a wonderful little theater. There aren't a lot of theaters like that. I don't know if there are any theaters like
it's
that.
It's still going.
Little theater. It was pure summer stock, where kids get up and build the sets and paint the scenery and do all that. And it was wonderful. And then my friend Katie Lindsay in Chicago, I said, I'm going to be down in Sullivan, but I don't know what to do during the day. And she said, I wish I could go riding. So she said, why don't we take a horse down there? I'll take a horse down there for you. I said, fabulous. So I kept a horse down there. But the people in the town were just wonderful. And here was this lovely little theater right in the square.
It's still there.
Really?
My little is still alive.
Oh, well, I give him my best if you ever talk to him.
Well, I'll try to. I wanted to ask you something. I lived in New York for the 60s and 70s and the 80s, and I lived very close to Tony Perkins, and I knew Barry.
Oh, yeah.
You know, his wife, who unfortunately passed away.
It was terrible.
9/11. And I found him to be a very uptight individual.
Well,
is this what your...
Well, the only thing I can say about Tony is Tony was, first of all, he's a very fine actor.
Oh, he is,
sense of humor, but very tense. Very, very tense.
Person. That's the word. Okay.
Yeah. You know...
I saw him in Equus.
Oh, he was wonderful in that. What a fine actor.
Yeah.
I saw him in Look Homeward Angel also on Broadway.
Yes.
He was excellent in that.
Yes.
You know...
And what
and of course, I was really pleased to hear later in life that he'd married Barry, that they have two wonderful children, and that's important. You know, if you can do that and be truthful to yourself, that's what life is all about, being honest with yourself
right.
and other individuals.
And what was it dealing with Tennessee Williams during Milk Train?
Well, Tennessee was wonderful. I was crazy about him. Not Tallulah was another story. But Tennessee was just great. And in the book, I printed a telegram that he sent to me that I just cherish because he was one of the top. I mean, look what he did for American theater.
He was effervescent.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thank you. It's good to talk with you.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. Other folks, if you want to call in, you can do that. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. You tell a story in the book about when you were younger, you met an actress. This was she was French, I think. I'm remembering that right?
A chica.
Yeah. Her picture's in the book, and man, she was just stunningly beautiful.
Stunningly beautiful.
Sort of reminds me a little bit of Lauren Bacall. At least in that one particular picture. I don't know, she may not have looked anything like Lauren Bacall, but that just sort of struck me. That picture of you and she that's in there where you're both kind of in three-quarter profile.
I think there are a couple of film pictures in the book, one with our director, William Wellman. The studio just totally destroyed his concept of that film. But Chica was a wonderful actress that was brought over from France for that film, and I absolutely loved her. And she was an amazing, amazing woman. And I just yesterday sent her a card in Paris.
You, at one point, were thinking about asking her to marry you?
Yeah, there were three women in my life that I thought of getting married three times. One was Laurie Nelson, I thought. I saw a lot of Laurie, and we were very, very good friends. But I just thought I would be dishonest to myself, and that wouldn't be right for her life or my life. The other was a chica. And then the other one was a woman who proposed to me three times. She was married to Harry Cohn, the head of Columbia Studios, and then married Lawrence Harvey. Joan Harvey was her name, and she lived. I found her first home up here in Santa Barbara, and she passed away a few years ago. She was quite an amazing woman.
So, if you're thinking about marrying, would that have been for companionship because you liked them? Did you feel sexually attracted to them?
Sort of yes, and sort of no. I was attracted to them, but more important than that is I thought, if I do this, marriage is a commitment, and I don't want to be guilty of ruining someone's life. I know there are a lot of probably gay men that have married. I hope they've come to terms, and probably they have come to terms with their lives. It's a commitment that people have to, to thine own self be true is major in life, and it's just something I couldn't do because fair is a wonderful four-letter word, and I don't know how fair I would have been in getting married.
Well, certainly there have been male movie stars who were gay who married. And you have to think that at least was in part an image thing. They didn't want people to think that they were gay, or if there were rumors about their being gay, they wanted to do something about that. And did anybody ever suggest that to you? Said, well, Tab, it might be a good idea for you to do something like that?
No, but I think you have to be truthful to yourself, and you also have to consider the other person. I just don't think you – and people – often play games with the human emotions, and we shouldn't do that.
Tab Hunter is one of those made-up Hollywood names. You were not born Tab Hunter. How did the name Tab Hunter come about?
Well, Dick Layton took me to—he wasn't an agent at the time, so he took me to meet Henry Wilson, who had discovered Rory Calhoun, Guy Madison, Rock Hudson, Lana Turner was Natalie's agent for a while, Rhonda Fleming. Anyway, he took me to Henry. excuse me. Henry said... yeah, he would sign me. He said, well, we've got to tab you something. So that's how Tab came about. And I showed horses, hunters and jumpers. It could have been Tab Jumper as opposed to Tab Hunter, for all I know.
We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, talking with Tab Hunter. He made a lot of movies. He's been on stage, performed in theater, on television. In fact, he's been in more than 50 films. He continues to work as a film producer. He makes his home in Southern California. He now has written an autobiography. He said he wanted to make sure that he got the chance to tell the story of his own life before somebody else did, and he published the book. It's titled Tab Hunter Confidential, The Making of a Movie Star.
Well, David, I just felt that I really had to just get out and do that before someone else did.
Well,
that.
I can you understand.
Get the truth out there. And, and I was so thrilled with the reception that this book's been getting, and I'm looking forward, to this tour that Algonquin is sending me on, which, is on my website, and I'm just really excited about all that's been happening. But when this is all over, then I can just go back to, I have one chapter in the book called, Happy to be Forgotten, and after it's all over, I can go right back to... Happy to be forgotten, because I really, really enjoy my privacy and my simple life.
Well, obviously, the reaction to you and to the book suggests that there are a lot of people who have not forgotten you.
That has been amazing. That really has.
So does that surprise you? Did that surprise you?
Yes, that did surprise me, because I lived a very quiet, private life. I've always tried to.
Mm-hmm. Something I guess that most people will never understand, with the experience of having that level of fame. I I think about a quote that I read once, and this you talked about having worked with Bob Mitchum. It was a quote attributed to him, or maybe it was his wife. He was having a conversation with his wife, and he was talking about his being a star and saying to her, you know, I just don't get it. Why people are so obsessed with me? And she said something like, Bob, that's because when you're up there on the screen, on the big screen, your left nostril is bigger than they are.
That sounds like Dorothy. She's terrific. She lives here in Santa Barbara. She's great. And so did Mitch live here. He was a terrific guy. He was a real man's man. He was just a great character. Totally off the wall and a fabulous actor and all so darn natural. Unbelievable.
Yeah. So I think that this is, you know, you can only imagine what it would be like to be the kind of a person who would, you couldn't walk down the street without being mobbed by admirers.
Yeah, I appreciated all of that stuff, but I really felt, you know, like I had two left feet. I mean, I just really felt out of step. You know, I really felt uncomfortable with it. The only thing that was comforting was in the work, because you become involved in that character and think of the fabulous people or the wonderful material you can work with. Now, also, I've worked with some terrible people and with some awful material, but the highlights are the ones that I look, you know, the things that remain in my conscious are the incredible people that I met and worked with.
Who working today impresses you as being really great actors? When you see them on the screen, you say now there's somebody who has screen presence and there's somebody who really comes across.
Well, great acting and screen presence are
two different things, I suppose, aren't they?
I think in a way, yes. I think the impressionable ones to me that I like. You know, I love Renee Zellweger. There's a quality about her I really, really, really like. I think she's terrific. I'm crazy about Johnny Depp. I think he's a chameleon. I think he's wonderful also. There are a number of people I like. Jack Nicholson, I've always thought was totally off the wall. He's so talented. There are a number of people. There are a number of young, fine directors out there. But the rewards are so great today compared to what they used to be. And they were great then, too, but not like by today's standards. That I think there's a great deal more greed and push and drive, and people are more first-person singular. And I do feel we have to learn to divorce ourselves from ourselves.
Hmm. I did, and you know, now that I guess I think about it more and more, I did use talk about acting ability and screen presence as if it was the same thing, and I'm sure that it's not. That's not to say there aren't people who have both. For example, Robert Mitchum. I think the man definitely had screen presence, and he was a fine actor. What do you think accounts for screen presence? Because there are some people when you see them there that you just want to watch them. You can't not watch them.
And they light up.
Yeah.
They light up. It's, you know, I can't define, I always call it X quality. It's a certain quality that comes across when and it touches you. And I think we've got to be accessible to have performances move us. People become so insular, you know, in this day and age. Well, it's not good. We've got to be able to open up as human beings. I think we learned a great deal, all the movies of the 50s were very la-la, you know, all of that nonsense. I mean, there were some fine movies, no, don't get me wrong, but people, after a while, after seeing the French and the Italian films, wanted real people in real situations. And that's what brought, I think, was very instrumental in bringing more realism into films in our country. Then it's gotten, the pendulum swings one direction, then the pendulum swings the other direction. I think there's a fine line that we have to live. There's an order. We get back to the word order, which is so important in our lives. And that is why I don't care for many of the films today, because they don't have something that I can feed on mentally, physically, or spiritually.
Do you still get offers for film work? Has
no.
Anybody? No? No one has? Well, it wouldn't surprise me if after all the publicity that goes with this book, you might get some. Do you think?
I consider that my past life. You know, I love the production part of it. I enjoy, and I love writing screenplays. I really enjoy that. I've done a few of those. I've created a couple of ideas. Our Dark Horse film that we did was born in my head. It was a wonderful little family film that I was so thrilled that it was well received for a small film. Lust in the Dust was the other one. I work a lot on screenplays with my friend Betty Marvin, who was married to Lee Marvin. She lives here in Santa Barbara, and she's terrific, and we have fun working on those. It's a lot of good work.
Mm. You were raised by a single mom?
Yes, very difficult for us. My father was terribly abusive, and my brother, my grandfather, moved us out of New York to California, to San Francisco, when I was 2 and my brother was 3.
That you talk about your mom a lot. Obviously, she's a very important person in your life. The circumstances of your growing up, how do you, and maybe that's not an easy question to ask, not that it's an easy one to answer, about how that experience shaped the kind of person that you are.
Well, she was a very strong woman. She was very difficult for her. People loved her. She could straighten everyone's lives out except her own. And she finally drove herself to, she was terrible, mental problem, and I had to, at the height of my stardom, I had to commit my mother to a mental institution where she received 30-some, oh, it's really difficult to even bring back, but I had to talk about that in the book, too.
Mm-hmm.
And we grew closer and closer, and the last years in her life, she was sitting out here after church one Sunday having breakfast, and she looked over me with that German accent. She said, "Was I that difficult when you were growing up?" And I, how do you respond to that? I looked at her and I said, "Well, let's put it this way. If you'd have been on the drugs 40 years ago that you're on today, we'd have had the best relationship." And she smiled and she leaned over and kissed me. She was an amazing, amazing person.
Hmm. Though you got to wonder to what extent your career, the person you are, was a product of that difficulty, and you know, maybe if you had had a more prosaic childhood, you never would have had the life that you've had.
I thank God every day for the life I've had, because no matter how the trials and tribulations that we all go through, we are still so much better off than the major part of the world. So just be thankful. And that's what I write at the end of the book. You know, how important it is to, you know, we can't lose sight of the important things.
Mm. You, in that little introductory chapter, the very first thing in the book, you write that you think your career was an accident that now seems both unlikely and inevitable. And the unlikely part is maybe the little easier to understand, just because it's unlikely that I think maybe that anybody would become a movie star. But inevitable, in what sense? Well, maybe you could talk about both of those things.
Well, it was unlikely that just this kid, you know, would be thrown into all of this. Where do you serve your apprenticeship? You know, I mean, gosh, that was difficult. Inevitable, it's something that I believe so strong, that I loved, and but it was unobtainable, and it was in the distance, but I kept believing about it and thinking, well, maybe I could do that. Oh, well, I don't know if I could. And I kept doubting myself and questioning. And, you know, you keep things in your sights, and pretty soon you accomplish these things, possibly. And if it doesn't happen, you say, okay, then it wasn't in the divine overall scheme of things.
Hmm.
Does that make any sense to you?
Yeah, I suppose. And maybe then, again, that's just, you know, how does anybody looking back on their life and the course that it take can answer that question of how, you know, how did you get where you are? How did it happen? Could things have
been You make a right-hand turn as opposed to a left-hand turn. The corner of your life is different.
Yeah. We're coming down to the point here. We have just a couple of minutes left, and I have somebody to talk with who wants to talk with you in Charleston.
Sure.
Line number 4 right here. Hello.
Yes, I remember from my youth Tab Hunter,
the
Blonde Adonis, and I love those movies. But my question is, there was another man came along of your same look and build and all. His name was Rutger Hauer, I think. Do you remember him?
I do remember the name. I think that was quite a bit after me, if I'm not mistaken. No, I think he was much younger, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay, well, it may have been in the 60s by the time he came along.
Mm-hmm.
But I just remember him, and he had the Tab Hunter look.
I do remember the name, Rutger Hauer, yes.
Yes, okay. Well, that was my question, and thank you, sir.
Okay. Well, I think you got it all over Rutger Hauer. I think he's a fine guy, but he's no Tab Hunter.
Well, you are you, I am me, so-and-so is so-and-so, and that's what's important.
Well, that's, though, I'm sure that that also was one of the realities of Hollywood, that after they had Tab Hunter for a while, and then it came to the point where, what's the old saying about get me Tab Hunter or get me somebody like Tab Hunter or get me, you know.
Exactly. And that happened at the end when I was buying my contract out from Warner Brothers. They were leading me around the lot one day saying, who does he remind you of, a young Tab Hunter? And I said, you know, the sooner we realize that we're all individual, we're all distinct, that's what it's all about.
Yeah.
You know, that's what it's all about.
But I suppose that is inevitable that it's so rare. There are some people who get to have long careers in Hollywood, character actors, I suppose.
Well, I love character actors because they're the backbone of the industry.
And those people get to work and work and work, and yet there are so many other people, they work for a little while, and they're forgotten, and I guess that is that then the studio says, get me somebody like this, but another one.
There's not a lot of staying power in Hollywood, not like in Europe. Because we always want the newest, the best, the this, you know, a gadget after 3 years is old, you have to throw it away and get a new one. I mean, that's just, it's just not my thinking. I don't think like that.
Mm-hmm. Well,
they do that with people, too.
For people who would like to read about your life, it's in the book. It's called Tab Hunter Confidential, The Making of a Movie Star. It's published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. Tab Hunter's been more than 50 films and continues to work as producer. He makes his home in Southern California. And Mr. Hunter, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, David, thank you very much. It was a difficult trip to make with the book, but I just felt I had to do it, and I thank God where it's going, you know, for my life.
Well, I'm sure that there are a lot of, as I said, I'm sure there are a lot of people who have not forgotten you and will be interested in reading the stories that you tell and what Hollywood was like at that time, because it's that time is gone, and I don't think it's ever going to be like that again.
It was one trip, very, very, very enjoyable, I will tell you that, and also there's a lot to be said for and a lot to be said against, but I put it all there. I didn't want to water it down.
Yeah. Well, again, thanks very much for talking with us.
David, thank you very much.
This is Focus 580, our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Coming up in the next hour of the show, we will be talking with Dr. Jeff Swearengin, shifting gears as we always do when we go from the 1 hour to the other. It's our monthly show on family practice medicine. If you have some questions about your health, you can give us a call. That's in the next part of the show. Right now, we're going to take a break for a market update and news, so stay tuned.
Focus 580 is made possible in part by a grant from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the markets. November soybeans traded through nearby support at 556.5 this morning, but didn't generate any heavy selling enthusiasm after reaching that point. Corn posting a